Hello, it's Thursday the 21st of October and welcome to the latest edition of Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. President Moon Jae-in has announced that South Korea's first domestically developed space rocket, Nuri, was successfully launched into space but failed to put its dummy satellite into orbit. We'll have the latest updates in our news briefing shortly. The ruling party's presidential candidate, Lee Jae-myung, has now come out of the other side of two parliamentary audit sessions. We'll look at how he fared, as well as recent controversial remarks by the leading opposition contender, Yoon Sang-yeol, for Korean Politics Digest. And then we'll also be discussing the crossover of art and architecture for Explore Korea Today. We'll have all that and more on today's Korea 24. South Korea launched its first domestically developed satellite launch vehicle, or SLV, on Thursday, but fell shy of achieving its ultimate goal of putting a dummy satellite into orbit. To give us the latest update on the nerve-wracking countdown and our other headlines of the day, our KBS World Radio news editor, Gu Hee-jin, joins us on the line. Hee-jin, hello.
Hello, Jang-woo.
So after years of failures, delays and heartbreak, South Korea finally saw what appeared to be a successful takeoff of its first space vehicle completely designed and built at home. However, President Moon Jae-in later announced that the rocket had not succeeded in putting a satellite into orbit. Can you tell us more?
Yes, unfortunately so. The Korea Aerospace Research Institute said the Korea Satellite Launch Vehicle 2, better known as Nuri, had indeed taken off successfully from the Naro Space Center at Kohung at 5 p.m. South Korea had hoped to become the seventh country in the world with independent capabilities to launch a satellite into orbit from its own soil after Russia, the U.S., France, China, Japan, and India. However, the 200-ton three-stage Nuri rocket had ultimately failed to place the 1.5-ton dummy satellite into low Earth orbit. South Korea is a relative newcomer in the space race. It has so far poured nearly 2 trillion won, or 1.8 billion US dollars, into the Nuri project since 2010. It plans to launch its first lunar orbiter next year.
Yes, unfortunately not a complete success, and we'll have more news on what went wrong from the Space Center as they complete its analysis of the flight, but still a major step forward for Korea's space program. Mm-hmm. Now, from one rocket to another of a very different kind, North Korea said on Thursday that its recent test of a submarine-launched ballistic missile was not aimed at the U.S. and expressed deep concerns over a U.N. Security Council convening a meeting to discuss the launch. Can you elaborate?
Yes, a spokesperson for the North Korea's foreign ministry said in a Q&A report issued through its official Korean Central News Agency that barring any obstruction to its own rightful exercise of sovereignty, there won't be any cause for raising tensions on the Korean peninsula. This unidentified spokesman then went on to say that the U.S. and U.N. Security Council could face more grave and serious consequences if they make the wrong choice. The statement said that the North has already expressed concern that the U.S. and UNSC are tampering with a dangerous time bomb. The latest statement from the North comes a day after it confirmed that it test-fired a new type of SLBM from the northeastern Sinpo area on Tuesday, which drew censures from a slew of nations, including South Korea, the U.S. and Japan. And, of course, an emergency session by the Security Council was called.
Yes, and members of the Council once again called on its members to enforce sanctions against North Korea to restrict the regime's weapons development program, but they fell short of issuing a joint statement during that meeting on Wednesday, I understand.
Indeed. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Linda Thomas-Greenfield, called the latest series of test launches unlawful activities and unacceptable, and called on North Korea to refrain from further provocations and engage in dialogue towards working towards a goal of complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. She also said U.N. member nations need to fully implement resolutions positions on North Korea and that they need to crack down on those who violate these sanctions. AFP reported that no council member proposed a joint statement at the meeting. At the last session on October 1st, held after the North claimed that they tested a new hypersonic missile, France proposed a joint text, which was opposed by China and Russia. Meanwhile, South Korean Defense Minister Seok said on Thursday that North Korea's new SLBM appears to be in its initial stage of development. The Agency for Defense Development, which is the South Korea's state-run military research and development arm, estimated a gap of some 5 years before North Korea can actually unveil a deployable SLBM because the North has yet to integrate the missile with its platform.
Let's turn to some other headlines now. Prosecutors investigating political favour allegations surrounding a lucrative development project in Seongnam raided the city mayor's office and that of the secretary on Thursday as they continue to search for evidence of corruption that may remain from the 2014-2015 time period when the project took place. Can you elaborate?
Yes, previously, if you may recall, prosecutors raided the Seongnam city on several occasions, but not the mayor's office in search of past records that may still exist from that project. And Thursday's raid came after our prosecutors faced criticism for excluding that office, which had the final decisive power in approvals and permits for that project. With the latest move, observers say prosecutors are likely to expand their probe into Gyeonggi Province Governor Lee Jae-myung, who was at the time serving as Seongnam City Mayor, as well as his aides. Meanwhile, prosecutors are also grilling four key figures in the scandal for a second day on Thursday. Authorities are speaking with Kim Man-bae, Nam Uk, Jung Young-hak, private investors in the project, as well as Yoo Dong-gyu, the former acting president of Seongnam Development Corporation.
Meanwhile, the former Prosecutor General Yoon Sang-yeol, a leading presidential contender for the main opposition People Power Party on Thursday, expressed regret over comments he made that seemed to defend former President Chun Doo-hwan. Can you tell us more?
Yes. At a press conference on Thursday, Yoon said he humbly accepts all criticism that his comparison was inappropriate. He also pledged to further honour public wishes and to work to achieve a change in administration, stressing that he has repeatedly called to include the spirit of the 1980 Gwangju pro-democracy movement in the constitution. Yoon said he never intended to defend or praise the Chun administration. The often outspoken Yoon sparked outrage and controversy at a meeting with party officials in Busan on Tuesday when he said some believed Chun did well in politics despite the coup and the Gwangju crackdown. In an attempt to explain his comments, Yoon said what he meant was to promise that he would entrust experts in different areas with authority should he become president.
And finally, South Korea saw its lowest COVID-19 daily case count for a Wednesday in 14 weeks, dipping below the 1,500 mark. Can you tell us more about the latest figures?
Yes, the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency reported 1,441 new COVID-19 cases on Thursday, bringing the cumulative total to 347,529.
We'll leave it there. Thank you for those updates today.
Thank you.
It's time now for Korean Politics Digest, our weekly in-depth segment analysing the latest developments from the Korean political sphere. This week we'll be looking at the Gyeonggi Province Governor and presidential candidate of the ruling Democratic Party, Lee Jae-myung, and how he fared in the face of questioning by lawmakers during two parliamentary audit sessions of the Gyeonggi province this week. We'll also look at the main opposition People Power Party presidential contenders and how they fared facing each other's questions in their latest TV debate. For all that and more, we have joining us on the line now Affiliate Professor Kim Byung-ju from the Hanguk University of Foreign Studies. Professor Kim, hello. It's great to speak to you again.
Great to be here.
Thanks. Let's begin with Lee Jae-myung again. He faced two rounds of questioning from lawmakers this week at the parliamentary audit sessions, something which he voluntarily chose to face before he stepped down as governor. And as expected, he was grilled over his possible involvement in a controversial development project in Seongnam in 2015 when he was the city's mayor. And although it did get quite contentious at times, no significant new revelations came to light. Professor, what did you make of the audit sessions and how has he fared at the end of all this?
Yeah, I think we have been hearing enough about the complaint from the opposition party saying that the ruling party did not agree to summon witnesses or the Gyeonggi province government did not cooperate in terms of turning in the requested documents and so on in preparation for this audit. So the opposition party was complaining all along that they're going into this with rather empty-handed, you know, other than the reports they got from the media, because the way it should work did not work out, the opposition party was saying. So that's why you said, you know, as expected, it didn't turn out to produce much of the surprise at all. And then, of course, the half of the time, like one-third of the time, the ruling party was trying to defend Governor Lee. One-third of the time, Lee was defending himself. And then one-third of the time, the opposition was trying to attack him. So because of this overall landscape, I don't think anything big was expected from the very beginning. But I think we have confirmed once again that this is not an issue that the opposition party can destroy Governor Lee with overnight. And Governor Lee did a really good job in terms of his own performance of defending his position at this public venue. We know initially, actually, the ruling party leadership opposed the idea of Governor Lee accepting the request from the opposition to be at the national audit. But Governor Lee, as you mentioned, chose to be there, and he did well. We heard that he was happy with his own performance and everything. But one of the takeaways, I guess, is in politics, performance and smartness, they are, of course, very, very important. But at the end of the day, the bottom line is whether you win the hearts and minds of the voters, whether what you do in this public event and so on lead to more votes or not. And that's a very critical question. And, you know, in the cases of like, we remember in U.S. politics, Al Gore, a very smart candidate, absolutely a greater performer over George W. Bush, but he still lost out. In the debate, Al Gore was always leading all the time. And then some of the observers say similar things about the candidate Yoo Seung-min in the opposition. He knows everything. He's very smart. His policy details are really, really you know, wonderful. But he looks, Yoo Seung-min looks too smart, quote unquote, too smart to win the hearts and minds of the people. And I think there were some evaluations here that Governor Lee, the way he laughed at the questioners, opposition party politicians during the first round, and the way he handled the questions and so on, there were doubts whether he actually succeeded in winning hearts and minds of the voters who will actually vote for him or not. So in that sense, he won the battle, but did he really win the war? I think the question really remains. At least that's what most of the observers seem to be saying at this point.
Well, some survey results from last week perhaps might tell us a little bit more about where Yi and the ruling party stand currently. First, according to the Korea Society Opinion Institute's survey of 1,003 adults nationwide from Friday to Saturday last week, Yi trailed both of the leading opposition contenders, Yoon Sung-yeol and Hong Joon-pyo, in hypothetical two-way races. Yi had 35.4% support against Yoon's 37.1%. Against Hong, Yi had 34.6% support to Hong's 35.9%. And the margin in both those hypotheticals were greater than the previous week as well. That survey was commissioned by TBS with a confidence level of 95% and a margin of error of plus minus 3.1 percentage points. Meanwhile, according to a RealMeter survey commissioned by YTN, after polling 2,022 adults nationwide from Tuesday to Friday last week, the ruling Democratic Party garnered 29.5% support, which was down 1.9 percentage points from the previous week. That survey had a 95% confidence level with a margin of error of plus or minus 2.2 percentage points. So, Professor, what do you read into these falling, these seemingly falling approval numbers for the DP and Lee Jae-myung?
Yeah, now these two surveys that you mentioned are important in the sense, number one, that the opposition party, PPP, People's Power Party, recorded the highest ever support level ever since the creation of the party. Of course, that's not a long history. Korean parties change their name all the time and they recreate it. So it's not a long time history, but still, you know, highest ever, you know, lead. Actually, PPP, Opposition Party, has been leading the ruling party for some time, I think about a month at least. But the reaching the highest level is a very important point to be noted. And then another point, second point about these surveys is that the in my recollection, this is the first time that Governor Lee is actually behind these two candidates. Now, not only Yoon Sung-yeol, but behind Hong Joon-pyo as well, one by one race. What we have to keep in mind is numbers change all the time. And according to another poll that came out today, I think numbers are different. And so, but it doesn't change the overall picture very in a very significant way. And these two surveys you mentioned are very important in terms of indicating the overall trend of these changes of in terms of people's support. In politics, they always say numbers are not important. Who's leading is important, is not important. How things are changing, how mood is changing is important. They all say that. So in that sense, these are new directions where poll numbers are heading. That's what we are closely keeping in mind. And especially what they call the reverse convention effect, you know, when parties have their convention and choose their tickets, usually it's normally expected that the candidate that's chosen by the party should enjoy a high level of support. But this time for Governor Lee, this is not the case. His numbers are actually showing the declining trend. And then also, especially in Honam area, and we remember Governor Lee lost to Inagyan in intra-party competition, a few weeks ago. But so it's not a big surprise, but still they are talking about very fast falling numbers in the Honam area for Governor Lee. So Governor Lee supporters are indeed concerned. And, you know, again, as I mentioned, either Yoon Sung-yeol, Hong Joon-pyo, whoever runs against, you know, Governor Lee, you know, their numbers seem to be showing up, showing upwards trends. So that's these are the numbers that, you know, analysts are closely watching with great interest at this time.
Well, now that the audit is over, Governor Yi is expected to step down from his post to focus on next year's election. His resignation is expected to come as early as tomorrow. What should we look out for with regard to Yi's next moves, Professor?
Right. They're saying as early as tomorrow, or if not, probably sometime before Monday, before the end of Monday, perhaps. And first step that's expected is that Governor Lee is going to register himself as official presidential candidate. That's necessary. And we understand why he's stepping down. We have all these laws, regulations that limits the head of local governments in terms of his or her activity and political activities, and anything that the person does to harm political neutrality is a cause of concern in the in terms of these laws and regulations. That's why he's stepping down. And we hear that one of the first things after registering himself as a presidential candidate would be meeting with, again, his former opponent in the same party, former prime minister. And we know there have been some emotional, negativity and things to be resolved between the two candidates. And once Governor Lee succeeds in, securing former Prime Minister Inagyan's support, he could actually turn around the overall trend that we were just talking about. So I guess it will be a very important step ahead. And I'm sure Governor Lee will try to maximize the advantage of having more time than the opposition party candidate who will be chosen on the 5th of November next month. So he will be thinking very hard about getting the most out of this lead time he may have.
Well, let's turn now to what's going on with the opposition camp. Four main contenders, Yoon Sang-yeol, Hong Joon-pyo, alongside former Jeju Governor Won Hee-ryong and former lawmaker Yoo Sung-min, took part in a televised debate on Wednesday in the southeastern city of Daegu, the heartland of Korean conservatives. This debate came after Yoon, the frontrunner, made some controversial comments earlier this week. He seemingly praised the former president and dictator Chun Doo-hwan, saying that Chun did well in politics except for the military coup on May 18th, referring to the Gwangju uprising in 1980, of course, when Chun brutally cracked down on protesters who demonstrated against the junta. His opponents attacked him for these comments. Professor, what did you make of the debate?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, especially exchange between Yoo Sung-min and Yoon Sang-yeol, when Yoo Sung-min was attacking Yoon Sang-yeol for his comments on Chun Doo-hwan, as you mentioned. I guess there are several points. First of all, I do understand, as someone who studied politics, I do understand the difference between governing and politics. And Yoon Sang-yeol was talking when he made this, I would like to call it his political mistake here, by saying that saying those things was his political mistake in the big picture, in the big landscape, even though some of the analysts believe that he might have calculated this a little bit to appeal to the core conservative supporters. I don't have an answer to such speculation. But when Yoon Sung-yeol was talking about in his mind the difference between governing and politics, and he was saying the governing side of Chun Doo-hwan, he chose best of the brightest of the brains, and he let them run the policymaking, function. And, of course, Yoo Sung-min said, but the way he came into power, Chun Doo-hwan came into power, he killed the civilians. That sets him apart from Park Chung-hee. Park Chung-hee did the same kind of military coup, but he didn't do that. And then Chun Doo-hwan is a killer of the civilians. That's what Yoo Sung-min was making. So both of them, they were making their points straightforward, but still, I think overall in the big picture, the debate itself, on this particular issue, I think the debate itself was to be used to manage Yoon Sung-yeol's potentially big mistake, those comments. I think it kind of worked in my own view, by allowing time to fix whatever it may have been a mistake, and kind of worked. And then in the process, was another impression that I came away with is Yoon Sung-yeol and Lee Jae-myung on the other side, on the opposite side, they share a lot of similarities. You know what I mean? These are really two tough candidates. And then we have to compare these two candidates with softer candidates in the past, like General Secretary Ban Ki-moon, for instance. I've read reports before that Yoon Sung-yeol and Lee Jae-myung ran into troubles that could have destroyed Ban Ki-moon overnight, but they overcame one by one, and they came all the way here so far. Of course, that does not rule out the possibility of any one of them or two, both of them being destroyed by the scandals. But this tough mental readiness to deal with tough questions, quite impressive. We talked about Lee Jae-myung at the national audit, but Yoon Sung-yeol in his debate when he was talking about Chun Doo-hwan, he was still pretty tough. And so these two people who do not share do not have the National Assembly experience. Maybe that kind of is one of the reasons why these two candidates on both sides are continuously making blunt comments. And
sure.
Some people believe it's their political skill and political asset, but it raises a lot of risks here. I just couldn't help myself noticing the similarities between Yoon Sung-yeol in the conservative side and Lee Jae-myung on the progressive side when I was watching the conservative party's intra-party debate. So quite interesting.
Well, Yoon has now officially apologized, but these sorts of outbursts in the past haven't affected his poll numbers too much, but this is one of the most sensitive topics in Korean politics. So we will see how these comments might affect his poll numbers going forward.
Right.
Professor, before we let you go, I would like to get your thoughts on someone who's been noticeably absent for some time now, but is waiting in the wings, and that is the head of the minor opposition People's Party, An Cheol-soo. For a long while, there was a question of whether he would merge with the PPP and try to run in their primary, but he ended up choosing not to do that. And we've been waiting now for him to announce his run for president representing the minor party. But what should we make of An now? What role do you think he still has to play in the presidential race? Is he still a relevant figure?
Yeah, I listened to one of his latest interviews with the media, and the impression that I came away with is that he is definitely thinking about the third scenario, meaning that both Lee Jae-myung of the ruling party and we don't know whom the conservative opposition is going to choose, but if the Yoon Sung-yeol is chosen, both Lee Jae-myung on the ruling party side and then Yoon Sung-yeol on the conservative side, in the eyes of their critics, they are both what they call time bombs because they have these scandals, possibility of being destroyed in the process. So An Cheol-soo must have his eyes on that, getting himself ready for that possibility and making him as alternative to, to the voters in this case. So we can see that. But I think his media interview that became a news recently, I think I noticed his typical style of not making things very clear. And of course, Yoon Sung-yeol and Lee Jae-myung are on his opposite side. They make points very, very clear. So I don't know how far he can go, how much mileage An Cheol-soo can get out of in this current political atmosphere where voters seem to prefer candidates with blunt and pointed wording or not. So that's one point I was reminded of. And he was talking about the merger with PPP is now over. And the scenario or speculation about if Hong Jun-pyo is chosen on the ruling party, whether he will run with him or support him and all stuff. And he said that's not factually founded. And then I think the last point he made again and again was that the Yoon Sung-yeol ticket will have so much risk and unsafe for the ruling party. So the last point made it his intention clear. So several points of observation right there.
Sure, we'll wait for his official announcement soon. We'll leave it there for Korean Politics Digest. Professor Kim, thank you as always for your thoughts, and we'll talk again next time.
As always, thank you very much.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 5.8 points, or 0.19% on Thursday, closing the day at 3,007.33. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also fell, losing 7.92 points, or 0.79%, to close at 993.7. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 3 won against the dollar, ending the day at 1,177.2 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We continue on now to Korea Trending, our daily segment where we check out some of the other news stories and headlines that have been trending online in Korea today. And for that, we have Chung Ye-won joining us on the line today. Ye-won, hello.
Hello.
So what topics do you have for us today?
First, we'll learn about singer and actor Chung Yoo-sung teaming up with Professor Seo Kyung-deok for a Hanbok awareness campaign in light of today, which is Hanbok Day. Next, we have an uplifting story about neighbors showing care and understanding over apartment noise. And lastly, we'll talk about the FDA's approval of booster shots of COVID-19 vaccines made by Moderna and Johnson & Johnson, as well as cross-vaccination.
Okay, so as you said, we celebrate Hanbok Day today, and you said there was a new campaign to mark the day. Can you tell us more?
Yes, as we celebrate Hanbok Day today, singer and actor Chung Yoo-sung, who is active as a Hanbok ambassador, collaborated with Professor Seo Kyung-deok of Songshin Women's University to produce a multilingual video related to Hanbok, or Korean traditional clothing. The 4-minute video was produced in Korean and English to commemorate Hanbok Day.
Yes, this isn't the first time that Professor Seo has joined forces with celebrities to promote Korean history and culture. We've talked about him several times on Korea Trending. But now he's teamed up with Chung Hyo-sung for this video. Can you tell us more about it, Yeowon?
Sure. It introduces the history of Korean traditional clothing that has been passed down since ancient times, and it covers the design and characteristics of the hanbok, which is divided into upper and lower pieces, as well as the various types worn in different situations. It also conveys in detail the aesthetic consciousness and attitudes, as well as the philosophical aspects that portray the lifestyle of our ancestors.
I see. So did Chan or Professor Seo have anything to say about their eventful experience?
Yes, Chan, who actually lent her voice for the Korean narration, said that she was happy to participate in the production of a meaningful video and that she hopes that everyone here and abroad will check out the video often. Professor Seo also shared his thoughts by saying, through sharing the history of Hanbok, which is a heritage of our ancestors, I wanted to publicize the value of Hanbok as a cultural tradition to domestic and international viewers through this video. The professor also added that they plan to continue to produce videos on Hanbok culture in the near future to promote it widely to people around the world.
And yes, as we said earlier, this video is available in both Korean and English, so people can check that out to learn a bit more about the history of Hanbok. Let's move on now to our second story. What do you have for us?
It's about a heartwarming story between neighbors that comes at a time when quarrels and disputes over noise have become more and more frequent. On Wednesday, a post titled, I am feeling great about my wonderful neighbor and so I'm sharing my story, which is a rough translation of the original, was uploaded onto a local online community hub.
Yes, we've covered disputes over apartment noise in the past, but this is a positive story for a change. Can you tell us more about what was written in the post?
Of course. The writer introduced herself as the mother of a child who would often stomp on the floor and cause loud noises whenever her child's friends came over. The mother stated that despite these distressing sounds, the older man who lived below her didn't complain once, and so she decided to give some persimmons her child had picked. She went down to the neighbor's house with her child, the persimmons, and a letter, but the man was away, so she left them on his doorstep. And in the letter revealed by the mother, it was written that her child had been in the hospital and recently came back home. Despite friends coming over every weekend and causing loud noises, the neighbor did not complain once over the past 2 years.
So hand-picked persimmons and a handwritten thank you letter, that would indeed be wonderful to find such gifts at your door. Did she ever get a response from her very patient downstairs neighbor?
Oh, yes, you'll be happy to know that the mother and her child did get a response from him. The man had also left a letter along with some baked goods on their doorstep. And in the letter, he told her not to worry, as all children are like that. He actually even thanked the child for creating noise, as it was comforting to an old man living alone. And the mother felt very touched by the neighbor's sincerity, as the baked goods he gifted were considered very popular items. And she could tell that he had put a lot of thought into it. The mother ended her post by saying that she realized our society isn't so desolate as she often saw other neighbors greeting children and sharing food with one another. The mother also added that she believes her child will grow up to be healthy thanks to the influence of their great neighbors.
Well, that is a very heartwarming story indeed, and it's great that it is trending in Korea today. And it's also a reminder that we can all find ways to be good neighbors in our own ways as well. Right, Yeowon, I understand we're going overseas for our final trending story today.
Yes. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA for short, has approved the COVID-19 vaccine booster shots made by Moderna and Johnson & Johnson. According to U.S. news outlets on Wednesday, cross-vaccination, essentially the, quote, mixing and matching of shots, has also been formally approved as well. The decision is part of efforts to prevent spread of the virus during the winter, while the highly contagious Delta variant has solidified its position as the dominant strain in the United States.
Okay, so could you tell us more about how the boosters would be administered depending on the vaccine?
Sure. In the case of U.S. recipients vaccinated with the Moderna vaccine, the third dose has been approved for those 65 years of age or older, or those who have underlying medical conditions or works in a setting which puts them at a higher risk of contracting the virus. The FDA also said that a second dose of Johnson & Johnson's single-dose Janssen vaccine can be given to any U.S. recipient 18 years of age or older who are eligible to get the vaccine. The medical community also recommended booster shots, as research results show that the Janssen COVID-19 vaccine's immunity rate can drop by at least 3% 6 months after vaccination.
And now that cross-vaccination has been approved as well, can you give us a time frame on when U.S. recipients can receive their booster shots depending on what they were originally vaccinated with?
It's, of course, by allowing cross-vaccination, recipients of the Janssen COVID-19 vaccine can receive the booster shot at least 2 months after the initial vaccination, and those who receive the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines at least 6 months after they're fully vaccinated, regardless of the vaccine type.
Right, and the U.S.'s official approvals of booster shots and cross-vaccinations will likely provide reassurance to other countries and governments who are making or carrying out similar plans. Currently, in fact, South Korea plans to announce its plans for Janssen booster shots as early as next week. Mm-hmm. We'll leave it there for Korea Trending. Thank you for those stories, Yeowon, and we'll talk again next time.
Thank you.
We continue on now to our weekly segment, Explore Korea, where we try to discover more about the country's history, culture, and travel highlights with our special panel of contributors. Joining me this week is the turn of our culture and arts contributor, An Jae-woo, and he has once again joined us in the studio. Jae-woo, it's great to see you again.
Likewise, Sean.
So it's been a while. I hope you've been well. So what are we going to talk about this week?
Yes, well, this week we're going to talk about a very recent online event, as a matter of fact, just last night, and KST, that is. And at this event included a small but significant online exhibition as well. It was conducted by Future School. Future School is the name of the Korean pavilion of the 2021 Venice Architecture Biennale. And if you're not familiar with this kind of terminology, basically, if we apply a little bit of, say, Olympics analogy, it's pretty much Team Korea in an architecture Olympics, if you will.
Mm.
Good. And yes, as I said earlier, this event happened yesterday. FYI, in case some of our listeners are not too familiar with the Biennale, once again, it's pretty much the Olympics of architecture. The Venice Architecture Biennale is considered the most prestigious architecture global event of the world. And another thing is, normally what happens is, since it's a Biennale, Venice takes turns in doing a fine art Biennale and architecture Biennale.
Okay. Right?
And normally, before the pandemic, it was the even number years. They did the architecture one, and the odd number of years where they would do the fine art counterpart. But because of the pandemic last year, everything got postponed 1 year each.
Right.
So, this was supposed to happen last year, but they're doing it this year. It's currently running until the 20th of November. And FYI number two, a special note regarding my personal principles in broadcasting. The reason why I'm saying this is I'm actually a participant of the Korean Pavilion. It's a great honor for me. And I'm actually a member of this very team. an atlas of global and local imaginaries. Now, the Korean Pavilion has 49 different teams this year.
Right, okay.
And one of those teams is an atlas, is called an Atlas of Global and Local Imaginaries. I am one of its members, and I'm saying all this because I have zero interest whatsoever in trying to juice out some kind of commercial benefit by mentioning my own work. I'm very sensitive about this because it's an ethical issue, so I'm going to make it very clear that I'm getting not a single penny out of talking about this work. It's only for the benefit of our listeners, because I think it's rather significant what we're going to discuss today, considering the nature of our listenership. But yes, we did a round table on the works that we've been working on for the past 5 months. So basically today we're going to talk briefly about the team, An Atlas of Global and Local Imaginaries, this team's mission, and then in just a little bit more detail, my personal project within the context of our team's group effort, and my project's application to our everyday lives.
Okay, so you're part of this team, An Atlas of Global and Local Imaginaries.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very striking name. This team is one of several teams involved in the Korean Pavilion of the Venice Architecture Biennale called
Correct.
The Future School.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us more then? What's been going on?
All right. So the mission. Now, first off, this might catch some people by surprise, but unlike, for example, the Olympics, for this particular event, just because you're a member of the Korean Pavilion, you do not necessarily need to have a Korean passport.
Okay.
Right? And especially for our team comprises 14 people from all around the world, led by the Swedish architect Anna Betancourt. And amongst those 14 people, only two of them are Korean, an artist by the name of Han Song-pyeon and myself. Now, the mission of our team is to share local projects which have not only architectural significance, but also political, cultural, and artistic implications which can be applicable to other areas in the world, hence can provide global inspirations explaining the name of our team. Now, last night, six of us did a live online roundtable. It has been recorded, and the link will be posted in the next few days on the Korean Pavilion's website at www.futureschool.kr. Now, this website is 100% in English, unless, of course, you click the Korean icon.
Okay, so you participated in this roundtable.
Mm-hmm.
I know you wanted to share more about what you shared during this roundtable.
Sure.
So what can you tell us?
Okay, so let's get into this. Just get straight into my personal project. And the title of my project is Art Phobia, Subjectification, and Architecture. Art phobia, that is not a word that is registered in the English lexicon.
Mm.
Subjectification is, but not in the sense of architecture. What I mean by that is the way I use this term is very different from how it's conventionally used in other disciplines.
Okay.
But anyways, what my project is a blend of a few different projects I've been working on for the past couple of years regarding the following 3 points. A, the general culture of appreciating art in Korea. B, art education in Korea. And finally, C, what those two have to do with architecture, or how we can rethink architecture in the context of those two.
I see. So your project is about how, I guess, art is appreciated in Korea,
mm-hmm.
and how that ties into architecture as well.
Yes.
So then,
and
let's...
the pedagogics behind it.
Okay, so then let's perhaps take a look at those 3 points that you've mentioned there. First
sure.
is the general culture of appreciating art in Korea. What did you want to explore there?
Okay, well, first off, I talked with my foreign colleagues about this quite a bit, and they've all kind of shared a very similar sentiment that, hey, that's not just Korea. That's my country, too, and that's my country, too. And for me, personally, I've had the pleasure and challenge of giving a try of living in 7 different cities in as many different countries so far. And I've experienced, and I've witnessed myself, that something very similar has been going on, not just here in Korea, but in other countries as well. But I call this the so-called wow phenomenon. And what I mean by wow phenomenon is, like, for example, it was a long week at the office, and now finally it's the weekend, and your best mate text you, so, hey, mate, what are you going to do this weekend? If you say, for example, you're going to go to the pitch of your favorite football club, right, and watch the match and have a cold one, that kind of a thing, and then they'll probably say, cool, cheers, good for you, right? On the other end, say that you tell them you're going to perhaps a poetry recital or a fine art exhibition or a concert of classical music. That's when they give you the wow. Oh, that's deep, that's profound,
right.
That's a little out of the ordinary, right? And that's what I call the wow phenomenon. And I, when it comes to art, especially fine art, I would say that the positive side of this phenomenon would be that, you know, as a society, we're praising high artistry, right? However, on the other side of the same coin, I would say that there's also a negative effect, which is that you're excluding this style of art from your everyday life. And therefore, spending your weekend in that kind of a fashion is a somewhat special, even uncanny kind of a thing to do. And one way you can translate this is that, all right, like for example, instead of going to a pop concert, if you go to a classical music concert, that's a really special kind of, you know, like really not my kind of a thing to do. And therefore, you can translate that as a form of art phobia. Because why would I want to spend my weekend doing something that wouldn't necessarily make me feel that much comfortable, right?
So it's that's about, I guess, how sometimes art can seem difficult to approach.
Exactly.
How it can seem exclusive when it doesn't necessarily need to be as such.
Sure.
So then that must lead into your second point then, art education.
Yeah, and you know, if you think about it, over the many years of observing the general culture of appreciating art, I naturally pondered on why this kind of a phenomenon happens in the first place. And my contemplation led me to rethink a few different related phenomena, including how we teach and learn art at school, from elementary school to high school. And especially here in Korea, I think all Koreans will agree on what I'm about to say here, but it's that art education in the Korean educational system is not necessarily about how we will become better appreciators of art, but how will you get the good grades in these academic subjects, and therefore that will make a contribution to you winning admissions of a prestigious university. And therefore, I've coined the term subjectification in that sense, and it explains how art, when you learn it in that kind of an educational culture, no longer becomes art, but more of an academic subject. And so after you're done with all that, you finally get into the college you wanted to do, I'm going to stay away from that from now on, if you know what I mean, explaining art phobia.
Sure, it's like dissolving art into right and wrong answers when there really shouldn't be. So then how does that relate to your third point, architecture?
Well, I think in that sense, architecture is kind of a funny member of the arts because it can be considered a style of art. If you think about it, it's actually, physically speaking, the closest style of art to us. We live in architecture. We make love in architecture. We study in architecture. We do pretty much so many things in architecture, including social distancing as well, right? However, culturally, it is farthest from us. Not that many people really consider architecture a form of art, right? And therefore, in the discursive context of art phobia and subjectification, we don't have a so-called architecture phobia because we don't really learn it at the, you know, high school or lower levels of education. However, there's no such thing as an architecture philia either, right? And if you consider the significance of architecture in the way that I've just said, that is physically closest to us, I think that could actually be a problem.
So I think I get what you're trying to say. You want people to think more about our surroundings and not even be afraid to question it and challenge it. But maybe can you give us some quick examples before we go about how or where this might apply to so we can get a better understanding of what you're trying to say.
Okay. So you and I, well, obviously you have a way much longer and richer experience in the wonderful city of London. I had a pleasure living over there 2 years ago for 6 months. But King's Cross Station, the train station, right?
Right. Right in the heart of London.
Yes. And now it's, you know, it's globally well known because of Harry Potter, I guess. But
sure.
The thing is, I just want to say this. You know this probably way better than I do. But the surrounding architectures of King's Cross, say, 20 years ago, very different from what we see today, right? Mm. There used to be this huge red light district and all these other things going on. When you have a red light district in that kind of a structure, and I think another famous train station that still has that kind of an architecture is actually Amsterdam Central, right? Because they have a world-famous red light district. It's one of the classical cases where the architecture of that area actually reinforces some serious social issues, such as the objectification of women. And what I'm saying by that is because of those red lights and those uniformly styled windows and how the women are standing behind them as if they're, you know, live mannequins, the men who go through these areas, the experience doesn't end there, because psychologically what happens is you go through that objectification, and then you have a tendency of sociologically labeling women outside the area as objects of sex as well. So these are the kind of things you can think about critically, I think, if and in a more social fashion, if we exercise a proper pedagogics regarding architecture.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating discussion. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but for any listeners who are more interested, can hopefully check out the full video of the roundtable soon, which will be available on the Future School website, futureschool.kr. That's what we'll leave it for Explore Career this week. Joe, thank you once again for coming in today and sharing us this interesting topic with us.
It was an absolute blast.
This is Scott Kelly, former NASA astronaut, and you're listening to Korea 24.
Well, I would say that bridge was very fitting for what happened earlier today. We finish up with a morning edition preview, our closing segment, where we take a look at some interesting feature reports that are coming out in tomorrow's editions of the Career Times and the Career Herald newspapers. For that, our staff editor, Mark Wilson, chair, has joined us now in the studio. Mark, hello. It's great to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Okay, so where are we headed to first?
We will head to the darkroom section of the Korea Times. Now, the darkroom is the part of the Times Weekender section that's usually just a showcase of pictures about a certain topic or event. But I felt Kang Hyun Kyung's piece that accompanies tomorrow's photos is excellent, even poetic, actually. Kang writes about something that is happening right now, especially in the surrounding Seoul area, urban redevelopment. Homes, three-story apartments, villas, shops that were built back in the 80s, they will be flattened or in the process of being flattened and cleared to make way for brand new apartment complexes. Kang talks about how it's happening to the small urban district in particular, Naesongdong, on the edge of Uiwang, Gyeonggi province. Residents have all moved out, and the last eviction order for the area came out about a year ago. I gotta say, from my own personal experience, Jung-ho, I've experienced it firsthand myself, as the downtown area near my home in Gwangmyeong, also Gyeonggi province, is undergoing essentially the same thing. There's maybe just one shop, I think it's even an ATM, that just lights up at night, and the rest of the area, for blocks, is just dead silent, pitch black. It really feels like a ghost town.
Yes, this is something that maybe you and I are more familiar with, but Kang's piece really seems like it can be an eye-opener for perhaps listeners less familiar with the many urban redevelopment projects happening in and around the capital area.
Definitely. Especially with the Times photographer Choi Won-suk's pictures. Excellent pictures. Now, Kang also writes about how the new residents will reside in such areas. Former residents were part of these communities for generations, but many newcomers, they could even be considered nomads, with many not knowing how long they'll stay there, because it all depends on real estate prices, right? Now, as the new complexes are built and lived in, a brand new urban landscape will be created as well. New trendy shops, stylish restaurants and bars, sophisticated cafes, they're going to open their doors for these newer, wealthier residents. Kang's piece is just a great read, albeit a bit poignant, but with Choi's photos, it's vivid. It's a vivid commentary on the sign of the times. I'd say, Kang, if you're listening to this, well done. It was a very beautiful read.
Yes, some people may find it sad, poignant, as you pointed out, that these communities are being broken apart and the history of these communities are being lost. But at the same time, it is also just a sign of the times. It's inevitable. Many of these houses in that area will likely have been very run down by now as well and not beautifully or lovingly built in the first place.
So unsafe when it was, as well.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. So it's a sign of Korea's economic success, about how the city is growing. And it sounds like these photos, though, are an important document of the changing times. Okay, let's move on. What's our second story for tomorrow?
I also really enjoyed Kim Hae-yeon's feature in the Korea Herald. It's about Kim Hyo-eun, the winner of the 2021 World Illustration Awards Professional Children's Publishing category. She won for her 2016 book, I Am the Subway, which was translated to English last year. The illustration book centers around Subway Line 2, a.k.a. the Green Line, that almost essentially circles the diameter of the Capitol. You and I, Jang-ho, are both very familiar with Line 2, right? The Green Line. Author Kim said that if you follow Line 2, you can really see the city's great variety of colors, from fancy skyscrapers to ragged hilltops. So she felt it was a great background to bring about the characters we encounter in our daily lives.
Yeah, Line 2 is central, literally, to Seoul. On one end, it covers City Hall, and then the other, it covers Gangnam, of obviously Gangnam-style, which
it's
everyone
a full,
knows.
It's exactly. A full circuit. I've even accidentally fallen asleep and done the full circuit. It's a very cool line.
Sure. I'm sure the author would have been very surprised by this award as well.
Absolutely. She told the Herald that she was pretty puzzled when she heard she won, because, it was some time since her book came out. Remember, her book originally came out in 2016, and the awards actually just happened last week. But she said she was even more surprised when she saw the responses from foreign readers. Again, it was just last year translated to English. And she saw how her work touched upon those abroad. It really surprised her. Now, to read more about her philosophy and what she's working on next, pick up tomorrow's Herald.
Yes, I can imagine that she might have been wondering why people in other countries might be interested in a subway line in Seoul.
Yeah.
But I'm sure many countries have similar subway lines. I know in London, there's a circle line, which, again, goes around in a circle around central London. And these sorts of stories connect with the people looking at who's on these lines as well, such as people who are falling asleep on them, as you said, Mark, after perhaps a late night.
Yes.
We'll leave it there for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for those stories, Mark, and we'll talk again next time.
Talk to you then.
And that wraps up our show for today. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow. So until then, we hope you have a great day. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you, as always, for listening. Goodbye.